An Osho Talk. The great Zen master, Ta Hui, reflections on the transformation of an intellectual to enlightenment. Number 6.
Only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower, will he consent to step back and reflect. Yong Chia also said, "The real nature of ignorance is identical to the nature of enlightenment. Original inherent nature is the naturally real enlightened one. If you think like this, suddenly, in the place where thought cannot reach, you will see the body of reality, in which there is not a single thing. This is the place for you to get out of birth and death. What I said before, that one cannot seek the Dharma, which has nothing to attain, with the attitude that there is something to attain, is just this principle. Gentlemen of affairs make their living within the confines of thought and judgment their whole lives. As soon as they hear a man of knowledge speak of the Dharma, in which there is nothing to attain, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. As soon as you hear it said that you shouldn't think, immediately you are at a loss and can't find your grip. You're far from realizing that this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life. If correct mindfulness is present at all times, and the attitude of fear for birth and death doesn't waver, then over long days and months, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar, and what was stale will naturally become fresh. But what is the stale? It's the brilliance and cleverness, that which thinks and judges. What is the unfamiliar? It's enlightenment, nirvana, true thusness, the Buddha nature, where there's no thought or discrimination, where figuring and calculating cannot reach, where there's no way for you to use your mental arrangements.
This is a special evening. Because one of us has left for the other soul. Anand Maitreya was certainly a man of tremendous courage. He has met me somewhere near 1960. He was a member of parliament already for 12 years. He was very close to the first Prime Minister of India, Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru. The moment he heard me, he simply dropped his whole political career. Even Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru has tried to persuade him. That there is every chance for you to become the chief minister of your state. He was from Bihar, the land of Buddha. But he said, I have understood one thing clearly. That ambition is hell. And I am not going to look back. Politics is finished for me. All ambitions are finished for me. And since then he has been with me. He has never asked a single question. He has never doubted. His trust was absolute. In these years, thousands of people have come to me. And many are lost. But he remained unwavering. He could not conceive how people can find contradictions in my statements. In 1984, sometime, he became enlightened. But he had chosen to remain silent. Hence he remained silent. He even did not tell me what has happened to him. But the day it has happened, I called a small meeting of few sannyasins in Rancho Rajneesh in America. And I declared that there are going to be three special committees, one of Mahasattvas, the great beings who are destined to become enlightened in this very life. and second of Sambuddhas, who has already become enlightened, and third of Bodhisattvas, who will also become enlightened. But perhaps will take a little longer time than the other two categories. But certainly before their death. And because I have included his name, he was salved. He wanted to keep it completely to himself, not to say anything about enlightenment to anybody. As he left the meeting outside, he told few people that it is very strange. I have been trying to hide it, but somehow he has seen it. And not only he has seen it, he has declared me enlightened. And his response was truly a response of great love. He said, Bhagwan is really a rascal. All these years before his enlightenment and after his enlightenment, he just remained absolutely ordinary. With no ego, with no desire, with no greed. Just before I came back to Pune, he told me in Bombay, that I have got 10,000 rupees in a post office deposit in Patna, Bihar. That's all I have. But now I will not need it. Certainly he was becoming aware that his time of departure is coming closer. And he transferred the money to Neelam for the ashram. He died without anything, any possessions. And he slipped very slowly, very silently from sleep into eternal sleep. I'm saying this evening is special because one of us has moved from the world of mortals to the world of immortals. He will not be born again. He has attained to the freedom and the liberation we have been talking about. This is a moment of great celebration and rejoicing. It happens very rarely. In millions of people, perhaps one comes to this silent explosion of light and disappears into the ocean of consciousness that surrounds existence. I would like these talks to be dedicated to Swami Anand Maitreya. Who slipped from sleep into eternal sleep. But he was not asleep. He has gone in full awakening. He has gone with full awareness. You will keep him in your memories because he has shown the path to you too. He lived joyously, although he has nothing, and he died peacefully. Blissfully. That's what means attaining to one's destiny. Those who live in misery and die in misery go on missing their destiny. They are failures, and because they have failed so many times, they become accustomed to failing again and again. But even if one person amongst you succeeds, it is also your success too. He has proved that what we have been talking about is not mere philosophy. It is an authentic path to self-realization. He will be missed. Just the last night, when I had seen him, I had a certain a strange feeling, as if he is going to depart very soon. And this feeling has happened to many other people too. as if he was gathering himself and preparing for the eternal pilgrimage. He has gone the way a man should go, joyously, ecstatically, you have to remember that his whole experience was based on two things. One, that he has fallen in trust with me. It is a strange language that I am using. You may not have ever heard the phrase falling in trust. Falling in love happens every day. Falling in trust happens only once in a while. And secondly, not for a single moment since he has met me, he has missed entering into meditation as much as possible. His death was not an end to life, but the ultimate culmination of a tremendous trust and meditativeness. Where trust and meditation meet, one attains to one's potential in its whole glory and its splendor. Now the sutras. Only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower will he consent to step back and reflect. Tao Hui is a strange mixture. Perhaps he is not even aware that the words he is using are not the right words. For example, wisdom is not a faculty. Intelligence is a faculty. Wisdom is your whole being. Wisdom is you. It is not a faculty. It is your wholeness that becomes luminous. But he is an intellectual and is trying his hard to teach people something which even those who have attained find it difficult to teach, and he is meddling people's minds, faculty of wisdom. And then the second word he uses, and willpower. Willpower is nothing but another name of ego power. A man of wisdom has no will, just as he has no mind. Because to will means to keep yourself separate from existence. It is a little subtle, but try to feel it. The moment you will, it means you are always willing against the things as they are. You want them in some other way. A man of enlightenment has no will, because the universal will is enough. There is no need of having an individual will. He has surrendered his individual will to the universe. Now wherever the river takes him, he goes. He is not even swimming. He is simply floating. Will is a struggle, fight. Will to power is the name of the book of Friedrich Nietzsche, which was published after his death. Because even he himself could not think how he is going to face the world when the book will be published. It will be criticized. Because will to power means a continuous struggle, violence for money, for power, for position. Life becomes a war field. It is no more a rejoicing. It is simply competition. And a very terrific competition, because everybody is trying to reach to the same place. Tao Hui uses the word without understanding the nature of meditation. There is no willpower. There is no faculty of wisdom. And he goes on to say, only if the person truly possesses the faculty of wisdom and willpower, will he consent to step back and reflect. the man of wisdom does not reflect. Reflection is another name of thinking. A more superior kind of contemplation. But howsoever superior it may be, it is a form of thinking. The man who has eyes knows that light is. He never thinks whether light is or not. And if a man of eyes reflects whether the light is or is not, one thing is certain, that he has no eyes. Eyes don't have to think. Eyes simply know, spontaneously know, light is. The same is true about when you have gone beyond the mind, there is no question of any reflection. You simply see whatsoever is the case. And because it is the nature of things, it cannot be otherwise. Hence arises a tremendous acceptability, called by Buddha, Tathata, suchness or thusness. You cannot do anything. It is simply the nature of things. All that is needed for you is to relax, be at rest, and accept the reality as it is. A total yes, holding nothing back. Naturally, in this state of thusness, there cannot be any misery, and there cannot be any suffering. There is only immense silence and tremendous joy. Your whole being is continuously surrounded by music, you are still and yet in a dance. A dance without movements and a song without words. But Tahui is not yet aware of it. He goes on quoting masters whom he has been meeting. Young Chia also said, the real nature of ignorance is identical to the nature of enlightenment. Original inherent nature is the naturally real enlightened one. Although he is quoting Yang Xia, but I don't see that he understands what he is saying or what he is quoting. Because the following sentences show his ignorance. He has not understood Yang Xia. Because he says, if you think like this, suddenly in the place where thought cannot reach, you will see the body of reality in which there is not a single thing. This is the place for you to get out of birth and death. Can you see the contradiction? First, Yang Chia's statement is of great importance. He is saying the real nature of ignorance. What is the real nature of ignorance? Perhaps you have never thought about it. What is the real nature of ignorance? The real nature of ignorance is innocence. It knows nothing. Hence it is clean, pure, unpolluted. Yang Chia is saying the real nature of ignorance is identical to the nature of enlightenment, because the enlightened man also knows nothing. He is also innocent, just like a small child. A very strange statement can disturb many who think only intellectually. The question is bound to arise in their minds that if the real nature of enlightenment is the same as the real nature of ignorance, then why bother? You are already ignorant. Now meditating and contemplating and concentrating and standing on your head and doing all yoga postures and fasting and going to the caves and to the Himalayas, renouncing the world. Why do all this circus? If the nature of enlightenment is just the same as the nature of ignorance, in a way it is the same, in a way it is not. As far as innocence is concerned, it is the same. But the child's innocence is corruptible, and the enlightened man's innocence is incorruptible. There is the difference. The child will become knowledgeable. He cannot resist. There is no way to keep the child continuously ignorant. The child's innocence soon will be lost. In fact, every effort is being made that soon he becomes knowledgeable, an adult, mature. But the sage has passed through all those stages of knowledge, maturity. He has come round the whole circle. He is incorruptible. Now nobody can tell him that you should try to know something. He has known everything and dropped. He has not only dropped knowledge, he has dropped the very faculty of knowing, the mind. He has seen the whole game is simply futile. His innocence is now incorruptible. So there is a similarity and there is a great unbridgeable difference. Tahui is quoting this great statement, but I don't have the feel, looking at the following statements, that he has understood it. If you think, he says, like this, it is not a thinking. You cannot think like this. Thinking always leads to knowledge, never to innocence. So the moment he says, if you think like this, he misses the whole point. And you can see how very intellectual people can behave in a very stupid way. Listen to the whole sentence. If you think like this, suddenly in the place where thought cannot reach, and he is asking you to think. And to think about a place where thought cannot reach. You will see the body of reality in which there is not a single thing. This is the place for you to get out of birth and death. One does not get out of birth and death. One simply becomes awakened. And one is out of death, out of birth. It is not a question that first you become aware and then you have to do something to get out of the circle of birth and death. No, the moment you are aware, you are out of it. They are simultaneous. Just as in the morning when you get up, after getting up, have you to do something to get out of your dreams? The moment you get up, you are out of dreams already. Otherwise, it would have been very difficult to know whether you are dreaming or whether you are awake. If there was some effort needed to get out of your dreams, who will do the effort? You are fast asleep, you are dreaming. Who will get out of the dreams? And you must have seen dreams once in a while When you dream that you are awake, and only when you really awake, you find, my God, that was only a dream and I was thinking I am awake. Awakening and getting out of the dreams has to be simultaneous. This life, this birth, this death, this whole circle of events in which we go on and on moving from one life into another, is only because we are spiritually asleep. Meditation wakes you up. It is simply a method of awakening. And the moment you are awake, you are out of the whole circle of birth and death. But he is still talking about you have to get out of birth and death. You don't have to get out. Even if you want to get in, you cannot get in either. I have heard one night Mullah Nasruddin saw an angel who said, you have been so virtuous, Mullah. I am going to give you some gift. And he gave him 1 rupee note. Mullah said, are you joking? For my virtues, just 1 rupee reward. I cannot accept it. It is humiliating. Finally, haggling, the angel said, okay, 2, 3, 4. Finally, they came to 99 rupees. Mullah said, listen, just for 1 rupee, don't destroy the whole thing. Make it just 100 rupee note. That seems to be correct, complete. 99 looks so incomplete. But he said it so loudly that make it 100. That his wife woke up. She said, what he is saying and to whom he is talking. So she shook him. So he woke up and he said, you idiot. You don't understand. I was getting 100 rupees from an angel. My whole night I have been haggling and haggling. And that was such a miserly angel. I have never seen such miserly people, that he was stuck with 99. And now you have awakened me. Just bring my glasses. I will go to sleep again, but I need glasses because I suspect that angel is so miserly. The 100 rupee note may be false. Be quick. The poor woman thought that this is absolutely stupid. In sleep you don't need glasses. But not to quarrel in the middle of the night and disturb the neighbors, she brought the glasses and Mullah put on the glasses and he started that, "Come on, where have you gone? Okay, 99. I will settle even for 98. And this way he went down again. But the angel was nowhere to be seen. The dream is broken. Now you cannot connect it. Finally he said, "Okay, 1 rupee. Now don't hide." And his wife is listening the whole thing. She said, "Don't waste your night. You can take 1 rupee from me and just go to sleep. And you will not get that dream sequence again. And for God's sake, take that glass out. Otherwise, you will break that glass in the sleep. And sleeping by your side, knowing that you are having your glasses on, I cannot sleep. I feel uneasy. That what kind of thing is happening?" So Mullah said, "Okay, you give me 1 rupee. In fact, you disturbed the whole thing. I was going to manage that fellow for 100 rupees. If I can pull him from 1 rupee to 99, now it is only a question of 1 rupee more. I was going to convince him. You woke me up and disturbed the whole thing. And that miserly fellow has escaped meanwhile. Now I close my eyes, he is not there, nowhere to be seen. You cannot continue the same dream again. Once you are awake, to enter into the same dream is impossible. And this is about ordinary awakening. When you are truly awakened, your whole being conscious, there is no question of getting out of birth and death. You are out of it. Now, even if you want to get into it, it is not possible. A young boy, not more than 7 years old, was arguing with his father that, "You have said yesterday that always remember nothing is impossible. And you said this statement is from Napoleon Bonaparte. And I say to you that one thing I have found which is impossible." The father said, "You have found one thing which is impossible? What thing it is?" He said, "It is just in our bathroom." The father said, "Just show me." And he brought the packet of toothpaste. And he said, "This thing is impossible. Even if Napoleon Bonaparte wants to do it, he cannot do it. Once you take it out, then put it back. I have tried my best. It does not go back. The toothpaste, once is out of the tube, no Napoleon Bonaparte can put it back. You try. You are a great fan of Napoleon Bonaparte. do this small thing. And just the other day you were bragging, nothing is impossible in the world. And in your bathroom the impossible thing is there. The most impossible thing in the world is once you are awake, you cannot go back to your unconsciousness. Just there is no way. Even if you want, even if you try, nothing is going to succeed. Just as you cannot go back in time, you cannot go back in yesterday, in day before yesterday. You cannot go back into a state of unconsciousness. And all your problems of life and death are of unconsciousness. Hence, these are very small mistakes, but they sow a great misunderstanding on the part of Tahui. He has listened to masters, but he is only an intellectual. He has not experienced the thing. Hence it is very easy to detect where are the loopholes. What I said before, that one cannot seek the dharma which has nothing to attain with the attitude that there is something to attain, is just this principle. Gentlemen of affairs make their living within the confines of thought and judgment their whole lives. As soon as they hear a man of knowledge speak of the dharma in which there is nothing to attain, in their hearts there is doubt and confusion, and they fear falling into emptiness. In the first place, he uses the word a man of knowledge, which is never used for anyone who is enlightened. He can be called a man of wisdom. He can be called a man of knowing. He can be called a man of innocence, but he cannot be called a man of knowledge. Knowledge always belongs to the mind. What is the difference between knowing and knowledge? Knowing is actual experience in the moment. Knowledge is when knowing goes dead, when knowing becomes past. Knowledge is stale, knowing is fresh. Knowing is the rose dancing in the sun, yet connected with the roots deep in the earth, alive. knowledge is a rose flower. You have put in your holy scripture, it has yet the shape of the flower. The color has fainted. The fragrance is no more there. And there is no way to make it dance in the sun, in the wind, in the rain. It is dead. It is a corpse. Knowing is living experience. Knowledge is a corpse. A man of enlightenment can be called a man of knowing, of experiencing, but not a man of experience, not a man of knowledge. These are subtle differences, but they make one thing clear, that Tao Hui has not got the experience about things he is talking. And to talk about things you have not got the experience is one of the greatest crimes. Because you will stuff all your nonsense into people's mind. As soon as you hear it said that you should not think, immediately you are at a loss and can't find your grip. Perhaps he is saying it about himself. Tell to any thinker that you should not think. Only then you enter into the temple of meditation. And he cannot conceive the idea. Without thinking, he immediately imagines without thinking, you will fall into a darkness, into emptiness, into ignorance, into stupidity. Without thinking, you will be lost. Thinking is the only light that he has got. He is saying about others, but my feeling is, it is his own experience. As soon as you hear it said that you should not think, immediately you are at a loss and can't find your grip. You are far from realizing that this very lack of anywhere to get a grip is the time for you to let go of your body and your life. If correct mindfulness is present at all times, now he sometimes talks so stupidly that it is amazing that he has been thought as a great master. He is saying if correct mindfulness, that means there is a possibility of incorrect mindfulness. There is no possibility of incorrect mindfulness. Mindfulness is simply awareness. It is a wrong word for awareness. But actually it means awareness. Because Buddha has used a word which has been translated in all these languages, Chinese and Japanese and Korean. That word is sammasati. Samma means right. And sati means remembering. That sammasati has been translated as correct mindfulness. But about sammasati, it can be said that it is not a contradiction. Sammasati is Pali for the Sanskrit word samyak smriti. From language to language, small nuances go on changing. Samyak smriti is the root word. And samyak smriti means balanced remembrance. In Pali, it becomes sammasati. There also it means right remembrance. Remembrance can be wrong. There are two kinds of remembrance, right and wrong. Right remembrance is concerned with your own being, when you remember yourself. When you are aware of yourself, that is sammasati. And when you remember other things, that is not right remembrance. You may remember 1001 things, but if you don't remember yourself, your remembrance is wrong. But when it is translated as mindfulness, then the whole word has taken a new meaning. There cannot be any wrong mindfulness. All mindfulness is right. And mindfulness means not anything to do with mind. It simply means you are conscious, alert, aware. If you are walking mindfully, it means you are walking with consciousness. If I am moving my hand mindfully, it means I am moving it knowingly. Not just like a robot. If correct mindfulness is present at all times, and the attitude of fear for birth and death does not waver, then over long days and months, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar, and what was stale will naturally become fresh. What he is saying is so stupid. That even to call it stupid does not seem right. He needs something more hitting. He is saying which can be perfectly right as an intellectual, but it is not right as an experience. And you can see it if you are just a little bit aware. First, whenever one becomes aware for 24 hours. It is not a question that you can become aware and then you can lose it and then you become aware again. It is not like that. Awareness is just like your heartbeat. You are asleep. The heart is beating. You are working, the heart is beating. You are talking, the heart is beating. Whatever you are doing or not doing, the heart is continuously functioning. When your awareness becomes just like a continuous undercurrent, then only it is worthy to be called awareness. So to call that if correct mindfulness is present at all times, it is present at all times. And the attitude of fear for birth and death does not waver. That is nonsense. A man of awareness has no problem of fear as far as birth and death are concerned. Awareness once arisen, you are free from the fear of birth and death. There is no question of wavering. Wavering can arise only if it is only an intellectual conviction, not an actual experience. Then doubts can always arise. In fact, they will arise. And then he goes on and on making wrong statements. Then over long days and months, what was unfamiliar will naturally become familiar. He is thinking of awareness as if it is a habit which you have to practice continuously. So after months and days, slowly, slowly it will become familiar. Awareness is not a gradual phenomenon. It does not come slowly, slowly in installments. It is an explosion. It is always sudden. It comes to you in its totality. It is not that slowly, slowly it comes and you become familiar. And because he is making a wrong statement, he goes on round and round, making more wrong statements. And what was stale will naturally become fresh. Now that which was stale, after days and months, will become fresh. Can you see the contradiction? What is fresh may become stale after months. He is saying what was stale in the beginning, after days and months becomes fresh. He is not even aware that even a small child who has nothing to do with enlightenment can say that this is stupid. As time passes, fresh things become stale, not vice versa. And the same is true about awareness. It goes on and on, fresh because it never becomes old. For consciousness, there is no time, neither days, nor months, nor years, nor life. Awareness is beyond time and beyond mind. It never becomes stale, and it has never been stale. First, you were unaware of it, now you are aware of it. It is the brilliance and cleverness that which thinks and judges. What is the unfamiliar? It is enlightenment, nirvana, true thusness, the Buddha nature, where there is no thought or discrimination, where figuring and calculating cannot reach, where there is no way for you to use your mental arrangements. Ta Hui is important for you to understand because he is a representative of thousands of intellectuals in the world who go on deceiving themselves because they can consistently, logically, think about experiences that have not happened to them. Perhaps they are influenced by people who have actually experienced, and their impact is so great that they start believing that certainly such things happen, and then they are capable of intellectual systematizing, and they can go on systematizing, but underneath they don't know a thing. These people are the theologians, these people are religious heads, these people are philosophers, these people are great professors, and these people dominate humanity. And these are the wrong people. Wrong because they are dishonest. wrong because they don't accept that it is not my experience. They simply go on fabricating beautiful words and theories and creating an illusion in the minds of people that perhaps these are authentic seers, enlightened people. I will tell you an actual incident that happened just in this century, in the beginning of the century. One young man, Ramatirtha, he was a professor of mathematics in Lahore University, and certainly a genius without doubt. It is well known about him. Perhaps nobody has done that way. In examinations, it always comes in your question paper. 7 questions are given with a note that answer any 5 out of 7. And this was his consistent practice when he was a student, that he will answer all the 7 questions with a note, examine any 5 questions. Because he always answered exactly right all the 7 questions. So there was no problem for him. You can choose any 5 according to yourself, whichever you want to examine. As he passed his post-graduation, he topped the university in mathematics. He was a gold medalist. Immediately he was appointed a professor, and he has all the caliber of a great intellectual. And just then Vivekananda has returned from America. A monk and a disciple of Ramakrishna. Ramakrishna was an enlightened man, but uneducated. Not articulate enough to manage to say something about his experience. He has chosen Vivekananda, who was a very intelligent person, one of the cream of Bengal's intelligentsia. And he impressed all over the world, wherever he went. He has come back from America, and he was going on a round in India. He had come to Lahore also, to the university where Ramatirtha was a professor. He was so much impressed by Vivekananda that he wanted to be initiated by him immediately. Vivekananda himself was just an intellectual. But a very forceful personality. very imposing personality. And it appealed to Ramatirtha immediately because they both were intellectuals. So there was immediately a harmony, a synchronicity between their minds. Vivekananda initiated him into sannyas. And he left for a world tour himself. And he was far more an articulate person than Vivekananda himself. Far more poetic. Far more impressive. Not as a personality. Vivekananda looked like a giant, a huge body. But Ramatirtha intellectually seems to be far superior. And particularly he was too much drowned into Persian, Arabic and Urdu poetry, which are all unique as far as their mysticism is concerned. They all belong to Sufi tradition of the mystics. So he had some new area about which Vivekananda had no knowledge. He impressed very much wherever he went. And the problem with the mind is, if people are impressed by you, slowly, it is a feedback. Because they get impressed by you, you become impressed by yourself that I must be carrying some great message. Otherwise, why so many people are mad after me? He became convinced that he is enlightened. The crowd that was following him everywhere convinced him that he is enlightened. When he came back to India, he was thinking a great reception. Naturally, an enlightened person coming back home, impressing the whole world, he directly went to Varanasi, which is the Hindu citadel for centuries. And where the Hindu learned people have their council, which decides who is enlightened and who is not. And none of these learned people is enlightened. But they are immensely learned as far as scriptures are concerned. So Ramatirtha first approached the council of the learned to get the recognition. Now to me, even the idea of getting recognition from someone means you are not certain about your own attainment. And you are asking recognition from those who are not enlightened.
on what grounds they have the authority to recognize you. In the first place, you are asking makes it certain that you are not enlightened. Secondly, you are asking people who are not enlightened themselves. That again enforces that you don't understand what enlightenment is. It never needs anybody's recognition. It is a self-evident phenomenon. Even if the whole world says you are not enlightened, it does not matter. And even if the whole world says you are enlightened and you are not, then too you will not become enlightened. And there something happened which is very strange. One scholar of the council asked Ramatirtha, this is sheer stupidity for Ramatirtha to go to the council. One scholar asked, do you know Sanskrit? And Ramatirtha had no knowledge of Sanskrit because he came from the part that is now in Pakistan. It was a Mohammedan area. There, the language of the learned people was Arabic, Persian, Urdu. It was not the part where Sanskrit has any influence. So he was very deeply rooted in Persian and Arabic literature. And certainly, Sufi literature has a beauty which Sanskrit literature does not have. Sanskrit literature is very dry, like mathematics. Sufi literature is pure poetry. It has a certain juiciness about it. Because the whole Sufism is based on the foundation of love. Sufis are the only people in the world who think of God as the beloved, your girlfriend. Naturally, they have written beautiful poetry for the beloved. The God is not a man, but a beautiful woman. No poetry can reach to the heights of Sufi poetry. Ramatirtha was at a loss. He said, no, I don't know anything about Sanskrit. I come from the part of the country where Sanskrit is far away. Even Hindi is not spoken. All those scholars laughed. And they said, without knowing Sanskrit, you think one can become enlightened? First, learn Sanskrit. And I can forgive all those idiots But I cannot forgive Ram Tirtha because he started learning Sanskrit. Just to get the recognition that he is enlightened by unenlightened people. I have always liked his discourses, but I have always found places which so impeccably that the man is only an intellectual. He has no experience of his own. He knows beautiful poetry. He can talk in a very poetic way. He knows beautiful Sufi stories. He can explain those stories. Very impressively. But he himself is a beggar. His bowl is empty. Such is the situation of Tahui. Understanding Tahui will help you to understand many who are in the same boat. Rama Tirtha went to the Himalayas. There was a small state, Tehri Gadhewal. And the king of that state was very much impressed by Rama Tirtha. So he made him a special bungalow in the mountains, where he was learning Sanskrit. To be recognized. And one day it happened, he had his secretary, a certain man, Sardar Purna Singh. He was a great writer of Punjabi. Certainly a very refined writer. His prose is almost like poetry. And he was impressed by Rama Tirtha, so he dropped his job, became his secretary, was taking care of his body and his letters, and from all over the world, the correspondence. And one day, from the window, Ram Tirtha saw his wife coming. He was married, but he renounced his poor wife and became a sannyasi. The wife was so poor that she was doing all kinds of jobs in the village, grinding people's wheat or washing people's clothes. She has not even the tickets. When he heard that Rama Tirtha is in Tehri Gadhewal, she sold few ornaments that was given to her at the time of their marriage. And she just wanted to touch the feet of Ramatirtha. She had not come to complain. She was really glad. In the East, that has been the tradition. If the husband becomes a sannyasin and a world-renowned although the wife was living in rotten circumstances, still she was very happy that she has a husband whose name will go down in the corridors of history. And when Ramatirtha saw her coming, told Sardar Poon Singh that close the window and close the door and you be out in the veranda and my wife is coming. Tell her that I am not here. That I have gone into seclusion, into the forest. And nobody knows when I'm supposed to return. So just somehow get rid of her. Sardar Poon Singh was a very sincere man. He said, this is strange because I have seen you allowing people, men and women, all to see you. Why you are preventing your own wife, which you have renounced? Now she is no more to you, no relation to you. Your preventing her means that deep down your mind still believes that she is your wife. Why you are discriminating between other women and her? And why you are so afraid? Certainly that poor woman cannot do anything to you. It must be something inside you of which you are afraid. I am not going to close the window or the doors. And I cannot lie to the woman. You have to decide one thing. Either you have to see her or I am no more your secretary, no more your disciple. I am going. Ramatirtha could not afford Poon Singh going. He was dependent for everything on him. So he said, okay, if you insist, I will see. And the wife came with tears of joy and just touched the earth, not even his feet. And Poon Singh writes in his diary that even my tears started to flow. That the woman is so respectful. She does not consider him anymore her husband. He has become so divine that even to touch his feet will be defiling him. Poon Singh touched the feet of Ramatirtha's wife and he said, to me, you are more religious and more understanding than Ramtirtha. And Ramtirtha felt so ashamed that you will not expect what he did. He immediately changed his clothes. He was wearing the orange robe of a Hindu sannyasi. He dropped that. Took clothes from Sardar Pun Singh. Ordinary clothes, not of a sannyasi. And Sardar Pun Singh, what are you doing? He said, I am so ashamed. I am not enlightened. I am not even worthy to be called a sannyasi. The recognition has come to me, although late, but it's still good that it has come to me. I have been believing that I am enlightened, that I have renounced the world. No. Seeing the wife, I could see all my lust, all my sexuality repressed. I am not worthy of these orange clothes. And then he went out of the bungalow and jumped from the mountains into the Ganges. Ganges flows just nearby, coming down from the mountains. He committed suicide. But such is the hypocrisy of the society. The same learned people who have refused him to accept as enlightened started calling him that he has renounced his body. It is not suicide. It is not crime that he has committed. Their actual word is, he has taken Jal Samadhi. He has dropped into water and become one with existence. And still there exists a Ram Tirtha League. There are followers, and his books are published, and people are reading those books in order to become enlightened. Intellect can deceive you, can deceive others. Beware of the intellect. Beware of the mind. Be very careful. Don't be impressed easily. Certainly don't be impressed through intellect. If suddenly a connection happens from being to being, that's another matter.